from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Ronald Kelson in for Tim Bruno. And on today's show, we're going to be highlighting Radio Catskill's participation in the One Small Step initiative, powered by StoryCorps. Radio Catskill was one of seven public radio stations in 2024 who received a grant to bring together local folks who had different political backgrounds. Through an application and matchmaking process, these folks had conversations with each other, varying in topic and length. We facilitated conversations between 38 different people from our area, and each one was special in its own way. We'll play some extended clips from never-before-aired conversations and show you that we have more in common than we realize. But first, news headlines from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The death toll has risen to at least 800 after a powerful earthquake struck Afghanistan last night. The Taliban government said tremors swept across four provinces in the country's east and injured more than 2,500 people. Omkar Kandikar reports.
Entire villages were flattened and people buried in their mud and stone houses as parts of eastern Afghanistan experienced the deadliest earthquake since 2023. Videos reviewed by NPR showed survivors trekking down mountains, carrying wounded people on wooden cots. Locals say landslides have covered roads and made several villages inaccessible. In some places, rescue personnel used helicopters to evacuate victims from remote mountain villages. One resident told NPR that local markets have run out of white cloth to bury the dead. He said many were still digging through the rubble in search of bodies. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News, Mumbai.
European leaders are drafting plans to send a coalition of troops to Ukraine as part of a possible post-war security guarantee. Terry Schultz reports the Europeans are working to come up with ways to help secure Ukraine if and when a peace deal is reached.
Ukraine has agreed to the talks, so European leaders are calling on Trump to put a price on Putin simply continuing to fight, and the European Union's own diplomatic mission in Kyiv was severely damaged in a Russian airstrike last week. So they're focused on what they can do, pushing through a 19th package of sanctions on Moscow and threatening to give some 200 billion euros worth of frozen Russian assets to Ukraine instead of just using the interest on those accounts, as is the case now, to pay for reconstruction. But it's really the White House that has the stick here, and European partners would very much like to see President Trump use it.
That's Terry Schultz reporting from Brussels. State officials have released the ballot language for California's special election this November. NPR's Ashley Lopez reports voters will consider a measure that would allow Democrats to redraw the state's congressional map.
The proposed language for the measure asks voters to, quote, authorize temporary changes to congressional district maps in response to Texas's partisan redistricting. Texas Governor Greg Abbott recently signed a bill at the explicit request of President Trump that creates five more favorable House seats in the state for the Republican Party. In response, California leaders are asking voters to approve a plan to create five more favorable seats for Democrats. This closely watched special election in the state could play a key role in deciding which party wins control of the House next year. The public has until September 4th to inspect the ballot label, title, and summary. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
Wall Street is closed for the Labor Day holiday. Stocks resume trading on the exchange tomorrow. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Students across the country are heading back to class, but in many states, one thing is missing: their cell phones. NPR's Sequoia Carrillo reports on a record number of states are banning the devices.
This school year is the first one where every student in Texas, public and charter schools, will be without their phones during the school day. But Bridget Whaley, an associate professor of education at West Texas A&M University, has a hunch how things will go. She spent last year following one Texas school's cell phone ban. The results were promising. Teachers saw improved engagement and more conversation between students. In Delaware, the state's pilot program for a statewide ban garnered 83% of teachers' support after its first year. These findings align with those from many of the states and districts heading back to school without phones. Students learn better in a phone-free environment. But there is one group not on board. In Delaware's survey, student support came in at only 11%. Sequoia Carrillo, NPR News.
Those tiny, fish-shaped soy sauce bottles are a staple in takeout sushi, but not anymore in South Australia. Starting this week, restaurants there will be banned from handing them out as part of a broader push to reduce plastic waste. The state was the first in Australia to ban the bottles and has steadily expanded its list of prohibited plastics, making it the strictest in the country. The sauce containers were invented in Japan in the 1950s and were originally made of glass or ceramics. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Ronald Kelson in for Tim Bruno. Hope you're having a great Labor Day today, and we're highlighting some previously unheard conversations from Radio Catskill's One Small Step initiative, which brought together strangers with different political beliefs together for a conversation right here in our area. For those who don't know, I was a producer on the project, which consisted of me being present in all recording sessions and making sure everyone sounded good. I also recorded, edited, and mixed promos to help recruit participants. And I also archived each conversation on the StoryCorps website, giving details on the conversation and about the participants. The full conversations can be heard on archive.storycorps.org. But most importantly, this was definitely a team effort. I would be remiss if I did not mention and thank the two wonderful women who collaborated with me on this project, Isabel Braverman and Judy Balaban. Isabel and Judy's titles were facilitators, but they did so much more than just facilitate conversations. They were responsible for outreach, traveling to various places and organizations within our listening area to try and recruit as many different people with as many different backgrounds as possible. Isabel and Judy were also responsible for matching each participant together and scheduling the recording, and I hope they don't mind me speaking for them, but I distinctly remember Isabel and Judy saying that finding a match for each participant was definitely the hardest part about this project. But even after all of that, yeah, they still guided each conversation and provided questions and made sure that each participant had an equal distribution of time to speak. So we obviously and truly could not have done this project without them. So again, before we move forward, they deserve the biggest thanks. Now, without further ado, usually you'd hear this man talk about the economy today, but he's actually one of our participants in this One Small Step conversation. It's James B. Huntington and his conversation partner, Judy. Now, this was a great conversation to be a part of specifically because it resulted in one of our first big coincidences between our participants. In this clip, you're going to hear Judy first reads James's bio, which was part of the application process when you fill out the application to be selected to be a participant. Questionnaire asked you to write up a short summary of who you are, and in this clip, Judy reads that and then responds with some follow-up questions about James's bio. And then later on, the reverse happens where James reads Judy's bio and he asks some follow-up questions on that. And again, James and Judy had never met each other before, and what you'll hear is actually a pretty interesting couple of commonalities that come out of left field. So let's take a listen to Jim and Judy.
Okay, so Jim, this is your bio. I am a 67-year-old man, 13-year Sullivan County resident. I have two cats and a girlfriend. I worked mostly in information technology, but had about four very different careers. I pick my political spots, but mainly am a never Trump Republican. I am a longtime WJFF volunteer and am now on the air Monday mornings. And, you know, when I first read this, Jim, I had so many questions I wanted to ask you. I wanted to know about your past careers, and I wanted to know whether you had children. I wanted to know about your radio show. And I wanted to know what about being a Republican was meaningful to you. And I'd sort of say, you know, I had this range of curiosities about you. What could you share with me that would be most meaningful for me to know you better?
Oh, any of those. Given whatever time we have, my careers have been, first I was trying to be a sociology professor Then I was a professional bridge player. No kidding. Then I went into IT and had a whole series of different jobs. Then I became sort of a freelance, unpaid economist. Well, even between just before that, I was an English teacher in Korea. And then right now I've done a number of things with the economics. I've written 3 books and I have been involved in various radio stations, not only WJFF, but over 100 more when I was promoting my books. And I'm now, I have a 55-minute occasional segment on a station in Altoona, a commercial news talk station. So, and I also have a blog and put out posts most weeks, at least when I'm in town. And yeah, other things. And I've done an unusual number of different things in my life. That's really what I've chosen. I have no children. Let's see. What about being a Republican was special to me? Well, I believe in personal responsibility. That's a strong thing. I mean, I have more complicated views on that. I think that the pendulum swings back and forth between times when the Democrats are right and the Republicans are right. And shall we say, without reservation, that right now the Democrats are right. So it's, I haven't voted for a Republican for president in over 20 years. So I haven't found anyone I liked. I was hoping for a conservative this time who would focus mostly on financial strength, but no such luck. And I would never, I absolutely detest Trump. There is no imaginable way I would ever vote for him.
Well, thanks for all this. And, you know, we do have something in common, which is that I also taught English as a second language.
Ah.
Yeah, for many, many years. And I think working with people who are so different with a different cultural background really prepares us to be able to deal with people and situations that are different where there might be conflicts or lack of commonality.
So where did you teach?
Ooh, I taught in a range of settings. I've taught immigrants in the public library. I've taught more upscale people at the YWCA. I've taught for labor unions.
All in this country?
All in this country,
oh, okay.
Yes.
So,
yes.
So they're a different sort of, you're catching new, yeah. Right. And I'm catching people who are learning English in school as they do in South Korea. And so there's another question, I think.
I think that's it for now.
Okay.
Okay, great. So, Jim.
Thank you.
If you could read Judy's bio. Oh, you got it. Okay.
Originally from Wisconsin, I grew up poor in a rich suburb, literally next to the railroad tracks. In college, I organized a union at my workplace, later worked as a union education director, then in disability rights. Finally, a workplace mediator for 30 years, now retired. Married to a former coal miner from Scotland. Sadly estranged from 2 of my 3 children, I treasure the nature and tranquility of this area, even the deer eating my lawn. I love movies. I care about social justice. So the first things in common are... Well, I'm a former union member.
Oh.
Independent taxi cab employers. And I'll tell you what city in a second.
Mm-hmm.
When you tell me where in Wisconsin, what was your suburb?
Whitefish Bay.
You're looking at a graduate of Shorewood High School.
Oh, my gosh.
And UWM.
These are 2 neighboring suburbs.
So were you near the food lane? In that area there?
Right. The Schradel apartments where the poor people and the newlyweds lived.
Oh, I didn't know that. I had a close connection, shall we say, who lived in that immediate neighborhood. But yes, I was a cab driver in Milwaukee for 6 months, and I knew the city like the back of my hand.
Oh.
And I always had a real affinity with maps and read them for pleasure. And I knew just the whole street pattern before I even took my first fare.
Well, we have something else in common there because I love maps. I will drive next to my husband in the car looking at the road map.
And that was a little bit of Jim and Judy's conversation. Now, you can actually hear the full 50-minute conversation if you go to the StoryCorps archive. And it was just a great thing to hear those many commonalities that two complete strangers, Jim and Judy, found just by sitting down and face-to-face and talking to each other for a little less than an hour. Geography, interests, little quirks like maps and things like that is just all just a little sliver of all the things you can find in these conversations and in life in general, having long conversations with people you don't even know. I know it may seem strange to go up to a stranger and attempt to have a hour-long conversation, but who knows, you may find something similar like that. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, more from Radio Catskill's One Small Step initiative. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we've got Les Baxter's classic Ritual of the Savage, plus new music by Whistler Molly Lewis and the M Squad Crime Jazz Quintet. I'm Daryl Brogdon. I'll see you where the music's shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Ronald Kelson in for Tim Bruno. And the next clip we're going to hear from is from a conversation between two very nice people, Kirsten and Jessica. This conversation was pretty unique in a number of ways. First, it was one of the few conversations, actually, that featured a bit of an age gap. Wasn't too big, but Kirsten was on the older side and Jessica was on the younger side. And they really also truly fit the description of strangers with different political beliefs. Definitely didn't know each other at all before coming in here, and definitely disagreed on a variety of topics involving politics and whatnot. But once again, that's what makes this conversation so special. And even with all of those differences, they still find some things to agree on. So let's take a listen to the first clip of Kirsten and Jessica.
Tell me about one or two people in your life who have had the biggest influence on you. What did they teach you?
So I would have to say with the biggest influence, I would definitely say my father. My father raised me as a single dad, and that is not like a common thing, I feel like. And my mom was around, but my dad was really the one that was pulling the most weight, and kind of watching him do that. And he had plenty of struggles of his own. And watching him kind of navigate those struggles and also raising me and my brother, he kind of taught me to be more accepting of people and realize that they're always something that you don't know, you know, to always just kind of give people grace. And he's always had, like, I'm sure all dads have these little phrases that they say and they throw in, and there's millions of them, you know, but I definitely feel like my dad has probably been the most influential person in my life. And then everyone that you meet in your life has some kind of an impact on you. So everybody else, I would say, is not as big as my father. So Kirsten, tell me about one or two people in your life who have had the biggest influence on you, and what did they teach you?
Like you, the first one I'll say is absolutely my father. We're very, very close. Like I had mentioned, my father is well over onto the other side of the political spectrum, but he also spent 43 or 44 years as an occupational therapist in Queens, where we're from, and he worked with quite a number of families who, like the ones I worked with, were either disadvantaged or had struggles or things like that. And my father pretty much always went, excuse me, the next step or out of his way to not only help the kids, do everything he could for the kids he was working with, but the families as well. Just a quick example, there was a lot of immigrant families he worked with. There was one immigrant family many years ago, and both the daughter and the son, who were his kids, they were both born blind. And the family that came over here, they didn't know how to get services and everything that was offered was available to them. Mm-hmm. So not only did he do the work with the kids, but then at the end of the day, when he was done with all his patients, he went back to their apartment and said, okay, here's what's available to you. Here's what you can do, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I actually saw him run into the mother many years later. And just to see what this woman's reaction was when she saw Mr. Mike, forget it. I mean, talk about my father just changing someone's life, yeah. her husband, and of course the two children. Mm-hmm. So things like that really inspired me a lot of the same ones I had mentioned also, of just no matter what maybe you feel about certain things or ideas you might come to something or someone with, there's no reason that you can't do the best you can for all of the people that you come into contact with.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I mean, where else are you going to hear answers like that to questions like that? Of course, a big thanks to Kirsten and Jessica for being so open and coming to this conversation in such good faith. And as you've heard, we get pretty in-depth here at One Small Step, and this next clip from Kirsten and Jessica is going to be no different. In this one, they're going to ask each other about moments or specific events that have influenced their lives, and you're going to hear some unexpected answers followed by an unexpected agreement. So let's take another listen to Kirsten and Jessica.
Was there a moment you witnessed or experienced that most influenced your political beliefs?
I can't think of, like, an exact moment, but I was raised with that, you know, country boy can survive kind of attitude. And like I said, everything that I believe politically kind of boils down to that, keeping the government out of my life as much as possible, you know? Like, yes, the cops are our friends and we get along with them, but also we don't necessarily want them coming around because we might not, you know, have something going on that's just right. But I wouldn't necessarily one thing particularly that I can think of, but just a combination of all of my life experiences has just brought me to the point where the government has a job, and we want to keep that job as small as possible. And things are just easier when people can handle them themselves and help each other. That sense of community, you know, like you said, you're from the city, you said, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I forget which borough.
Queens.
Queens, okay. And I'm from Livingston Manor, which is a small town. So I grew up where we didn't have huge rec centers and big groups that were helping. There was no Boys and Girls Club. There still is no Boys and Girls Club, you know? And when I was growing up, everybody's parent was being an umpire at Little League. And all the families came at the beginning of the season and cleaned up all of the fields from the brush. And we all made hot dogs and hamburgers and made a day out of it. And we were there for all of the Memorial Day parades, and my dad is a volunteer fireman. He's actually the chief now. And so I always just kind of was involved in my community. Everybody knows each other, still do. My kids go to the same school I went to, and half of their teachers were my teachers. And whoever wasn't one of my teachers, I went to school with. So it's just we are really small and tight-knit, and we're used to helping each other through good and bad. And I feel like if we can do that in our town, I don't see why it can't be done everywhere, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So do you feel like there's one thing that influenced you the most?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Being from New York City and being 43 at this point, the September 11th attacks, all of us there had a life change. Everybody had a life changing experience that day. Just about everyone lost someone or something awful like that. And for me, not just that day was a life changing experience. I worked in Manhattan. I was not there that day. I was there the day after. So I walked down with my friend who was in NYU at the time. I didn't get on the subway. I was terrified of the subway. I didn't get on the subway for 3 months after that because it was too easy for someone to just put a duffel bag down and walk away. Mm-hmm. So I walked down to, we called it the pile. At the time, it wasn't Ground Zero yet. Yeah. It was the pile. So I walked down there and I saw the smoking ruins. I smelled what it smelled like. And I saw these pictures you see of like that twisted sort of metal, I don't know, facade thing that was hanging over bits. It's just there's pictures of it. I saw that. So that was obviously really, really affecting me. And then just like just about everyone in the beginning, we all were like, kill them all, let God sort them out. Absolutely all of us. But shortly thereafter, once the reports started coming in of who these monsters were, where they got trained, where they were from, so on and so forth, we learned just that information. And then all of a sudden, we, the military was marching into Iraq. And I sat back and I said, no one said anything about Iraq in any of those reports. None of them were from there. None of them trained there. None of them, as far as we knew, had anything to do with that. So that really took me aback. And that made me really start to question the decisions that the government was making with regards to the lives of just so many Americans. And I mean, the world, really. And from there, it kind of was a little bit of a cascading effect of, let me more critically look at the government and government decisions and who's deciding what needs to be where and where we point our really considerable power that we have in the world. And it really kind of just went from there as I got older and read more and looked up more and did more and stuff like that. So, yeah, the September 11th attacks, that was a day that, like many, many, many people, absolutely changed my life.
Yeah. I was in early elementary school when the September 11th attacks happened. So I really don't have that kind of experience to relate to you with, you know. I barely even remember it happening, and only because I know that it happened that day, you know. So I can't even imagine what it would be like to have actually witnessed it and seen it. But I do recognize the fact that there was a strong patriotic movement after that, rightfully so. But I also do agree with you that looking into what the government is doing and why and watching the moves it makes, and I feel like not necessarily that event, but for that reason is why I do lean more to the right. Because I believe that the federal government should not have as much power as it does. I believe that it really shouldn't matter all that much who the president is. I believe that the federal government should have so much little power that it really doesn't affect your life day to day. Obviously, I realize that the United States is a large, you know, power nation, whatever you want to call it. It does matter, but that's why I lean more to the right, because I would love to see less federal government than there is.
From my more recent experience with things, my husband was already in the Marine Corps when that happened. Oh, wow. He was a few months away from his enlistment being up. He was going to go back to Michigan and work with his dad and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. That happened. And he said, I know what I'm doing with the rest of my life.
Sign me up.
And exactly. Yep. And seeing what he and his fellow soldiers did and went through, and the mental and physical after effects of a lifetime of war, 20 plus years of war, regardless of how I feel about this or that or where we went, what we did, I will say the decisions of at least his generation of soldiers is beyond admirable, just because I've seen what these men and women, but my husband's a combat veteran, so the men on the front lines, what not only did they do, but what they gave up in service of a higher cause, in service of feeling like they were doing something that was bigger than any of them.
Wow. So, again, as you can see, some similarities are found in these conversations. You know, when Jessica was talking about what ensued after the September 11th attacks and her not necessarily really remembering it, even though she was certainly older than actually I was when the September 11th attacks happened, and Kirsten being the one who so vividly remembered what it was like and actually going down there the next day and being aware and being conscious of the response afterwards was certainly interesting to hear about. And again, certainly different than I think what most people would expect when that question arises to people like Kirsten and Jessica. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, more from Radio Catskill's One Small Step initiative. This is Radio Catskill.
Celebrate 35 years of Radio Catskill at the Lou Beach Community House Summer Jubilee. Join us on Saturday, September 13th from 5 to 8 p.m. for live music from Calla Sun and Lolly and the Pops and a DJ set by the Mixtape's Jason Dugan, plus cold beer from Catskill Brewery. Tickets are $25 and proceeds benefit Radio Catskill. More information at wjffradio.org. The Lou Beach Community House Summer Jubilee, a project of the Beaverkill Valley Land Trust.
We can't afford to be gradualists at this point. Love is radical. Love makes the big change. Love was given to us by the earth to make life. That's why it's the strongest force. Love makes life.
I'm Jason Dolan. That's Reverend Billy speaking to me at Bethel Woods last week. Hear my full conversation with him, plus one more story from an attendee of the original Woodstock Festival and the latest New York State news. We're going back to the garden one last time this summer tonight at 6 on the local edition.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Ronald Kelson in for Tim Bruno. If you're just joining me, I'm highlighting some never-before-heard conversations from Radio Catskill's One Small Step initiative, which brought together strangers with different political beliefs together for a conversation right here in our area. Now, one of the many benefits of being able to sit in with every conversation and listen to all of our participants last year was that I learned that everyone seemed to have such an appreciation and gratitude for the area in which we live. There were certainly multiple instances that I can recall of all our participants bonding over how lucky they felt that they were to be living in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania right now. And not only that, but a lot of people who live here currently have come from somewhere else or had extraordinary experiences somewhere else. And despite that, they find themselves here. So let's take a listen to our next conversation between Greg and Nancy, who in this one start off by reading each other's bios, and they get to talk about where they're from, where they've been, and why they decided here is home.
Greg, could you read Nancy's bio, please?
Yes, I'd love to. I got to put my glasses on. 1945, born in Pittsburgh to a Republican family, but changed her political views in college. After my first husband died at age 30, I had to figure out what to do with the rest of my life and decided I wanted to work with apes. Through a long and lucky chain of events, I ended up doing the research on my PhD with
Bonobos,
the first American to do so. I was fortunate to do this research with my second husband, who happened to be my late husband's best friend. Bought home in Berryville in 2009.
Have any questions you'd like to ask?
Yeah, the apes.
Everybody'd like to hear about the
Absolutely.
Apes.
Absolutely. Where did you go to research?
It was then Zaire. It's now Democratic Republic of the Congo. And it was the best part of my life. I just loved it. But it was broken up because I was in graduate school. And so I was 2 years there, starting in 80 to 82, then 84 to 86. Then it took me a long time to write my dissertation. And we went back, and we had to evacuate. At first, it took us 3 months to even get into our site, and then we had to evacuate. And the country was in such stress that we couldn't get funding, and we never got back. So we went on to other things.
So did you stay with the apes, or did you?
Yeah, I lived right with them. Our study site was in the middle of the Lamako Forest, and it was a 35-kilometer walk into the study site from the end of nowhere, which was a palm oil plantation. And, you know, our houses were built on site out of sticks, but we got to see them in their natural environment. And it takes a long time to habituate animals. And because we were broken up, we never got them to the point where we could follow them on the ground. But they're very arboreal, so we got to watch them.
Ever have an issue with one of them attacking or anything? That would be
probably no. They're fairly gentle creatures. There were other things there, like leopards and stuff that we encountered, and you know, but it was a good life.
Why'd you come back?
Well, because we couldn't get any funding.
That's right.
Okay. Right. Jeez.
Okay. Interesting.
Right.
Yeah. Any other questions?
I just admire that you took on a trek like that and had to walk 20 miles into get to, base camp, I guess they'd call it?
Yeah.
And how did you, what about food and everything else?
That was interesting. I mean, we ate some local things. They grew some manioc there, so we ate that. And they had two kinds, sweet manioc and sour manioc. And the sour was really horrible. It was this yicky mess, and it was called vomita in their local language. Oh, but we also ate fish. One of them was an electric catfish. They were huge and had big bones, so it was fun. And
what was the first thing you – what's it called? Manioc. What is that?
It's a plant? They tend to eat the leaves more in South America, and it grows in Africa as well. But they eat the root as well. But we also took a lot of food in. And one thing that's sort of funny was that we were baking in a tin kind of chest that was probably made in China, and it was just sat on a little tripod over a wood fire. But I made bread every Sunday, which we would take off if we didn't know where they were, and get stung by bees while I was, you know, doing it.
Pretty interesting.
It was an interesting life.
That was back what year?
Well, it started in 80 and ended around 91.
Wow.
And then we went on to other jobs in Africa.
Thank you. Yeah. Very nice.
Nancy, would you read Greg's bio, please?
Yeah. Short and sweet. I grew up in Roscoe and graduated in 1973 and then worked. I'm entering my 50th year in insurance. I'm married with two sons and five grandkids. And I enjoy being active in the community.
Do you have any questions that you'd like to ask?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, first of all, just about living in this area. And we both live in beautiful places, I think, and we're, you know, tied into the resources. What do you do, a lot of activity, hiking or
fly fishing or?
Well, excuse me, being born and raised in Roscoe, fishing was the thing. You know, I worked at the Antrim Lodge, which was, you know, the Beaver Kill, Willowaymock, met a lot of people when I worked at the Antrim. Arnold Gingrich, who wrote The Joys of Trout, I met him.
Oh, wow.
One of my clients was Lee Wolf, and Joan Wolf is still around, one of the best fisher people in the world for salmon fishing. So, you know, Roscoe was, we never went past Liberty. We went to Liberty to do our shopping at the Town and Country, and we had burners for sneakers. So Roscoe was pretty much self-contained back in there, and it was, you know, small community, and loved growing up there.
Right.
So, and I, you know, was, you know, played in sports and all that good stuff, and loved being in Sullivan County.
Right. From what you said earlier, you obviously like to hike, and you like to travel.
Do like to travel, yes. And
so tell me about some of the places you've gone.
Well, we've been to Africa, which we went back in 2018 already. That was
what country?
It was Zimbabwe. We went, you know, we did elephants. We saw elephants, giraffes, everything I wanted to see, like, you know, lion, cubs, you know, from here to you. It was just fantastic. Excuse me. Went to Johannesburg just to learn how Mandela and just what happened there is just totally amazing as far as the number of whites to blacks and, you know, how things went there. But we've been to – my mom was born in Belgium, so she was a war bride. So I've been to Belgium a few times. We've been to the Netherlands. We've been to Iceland. We've been to Ireland, Italy, Austria, Switzerland. So we've taken our sons traveling also. We thought that we were fortunate that we could do it, and also it was a great experience for the boys. Yeah. So we've done a lot, but Africa races number one. And we just got back from Portugal a week ago. So, but Africa, I do want to go back before. Right.
I have a new place to suggest to you that we went that I thought was so fantastic. And it's the Pantanal of Brazil. It's the world's largest wetland. But we saw, and I don't walk as well as I used to, this was actually a safari within that you did some walking, but you also had safari cars. But you saw things like giant anteaters and jaguars everywhere. Really? It was amazing. Look it up.
Pantanello?
Pantanal, Pantanal.
Yeah, one thing, we have not been to Brazil. And we did go to Machu Picchu, Peru. Uh-huh. Peru was probably the one of my favorite countries also to go to. The people were lovely, and it was just a beautiful place.
Yeah. And I'm just working on it now. We're probably going to go to the Amazon on a monkey tour with a friend who, she started with us but ended up working with lowland gorillas. But she's never seen South American monkeys, so we're going to a place for 10 days in Peru.
Now, do you get to, is it like a volunteer?
No.
That you go?
No, you pay.
You pay?
But it's reasonable.
And how many people go on the trip?
As many as you want. Okay. We will just be four with our own guides and stuff.
The folks, there's four of you with your own guides. Then.
Yeah.
So you're, well, that's wonderful.
It's a good place, too.
Yeah. It's, and everybody's worried about taking the shots and everything, but obviously it doesn't bother you getting the vaccination.
Weirdly enough, you don't. Actually, there are no mosquitoes there that are dangerous, so you don't have to worry about malaria.
Well, then I got to ask you, how'd you get to Berryville?
Well,
I've never seen monkeys in Berryville.
Having lived in surrounded by a huge rainforest, we came back and we had inherited a co-op in New York, and we just got really tired of concrete. And so we were looking for green, and I just saw these cottages advertised that looked kind of cute, and we came up, and as we were driving up, my husband, who used to come to camp here, said, "This looks like New York as I remember it."
New York State,
and that kind of did it for me, and we had the chance It was basically a new development, but we bought the old farmhouse, and it had 60 acres, and they divided it up basically into five-acre lots, but we got what we wanted because we had a little pond and a little garage barn thing that my husband uses as a studio, as he also does sculpture and things.
Well, we're glad you, well, obviously it's nice that you came to Sullivan County, and, you know, a lot more people are coming to Sullivan County, which is great also, you know, it's, you know, but that, so.
Has that happened to your area as well?
Well, if you go to Woodburn, yes, where our office has been since 1928, obviously the landscape has changed there as it has in South Fallsburg, where my wife grew up, Linda grew up in South Fallsburg. But in town of Neversink, we have the reservoir, so that's sort of, you know, the city of New York sort of controls what you can and can't do in our area, which is good and bad in some cases. But we love Neversink. It's, you know, gorgeous. Unfortunately, the fires we've had, you know, the past couple of days. But it's just, we love living here. You know, we go away and we love coming back, you know. And Linda taught at Tri-Valley for 38 years, so we knew that was a good sign. So we moved there in 84. So we got married in 75. So it's, we love it. We love Sullivan County. And, you know, I think it has a lot to offer. It really does.
Now, for us, it was amazing to me because it, well, partially because it was a new community. We just made so many friends so quickly. Yes. And it's great. You know, right now, one friend is in the hospital long term, and you know, we're taking turns taking care of his cats and, you know, cooking food for him. And
That's what's great, you know, too. We have three horses. I call them just field ornaments. But one got out this morning, and they called up, Greg, Lucky's out. So we just, and this is what happened. But this is what's great about a small community, too. And, you know, we have our problems here, but still, I still think it's one of the best places to live.
Yeah.
And we're, the proximity to the city with hospitals and things of that nature, you can be there in 2 hours.
Right.
The airport. It's just a lovely area. But the landscape's changing, as we know. You know, that's going to happen. And we just have to, hopefully, everybody can live together and understand, you know, their differences and everything.
But I found it interesting that with COVID, we didn't go to the city at all. And now we don't want to anymore. My husband went down for a doctor's appointment yesterday, and he said, I had to stop and think about which way was north, and he grew up there, you know, and he was disoriented.
Yeah, so. No, it's, but we do have a lot to be thankful up here.
Oh, yeah.
And young people getting in the area and starting to get involved, which to me is very important. It really is. It's, because we have, you know, like I said, we have our issues, but, you know, we're trying the best we can to alleviate those. So I still think it's a great place to live.
Thank you to Greg and Nancy again for consenting to be so open and so honest with their answers and their life experiences. And yeah, I just found it wonderful to hear about everyone's appreciation and gratitude for living in the area, in Catskills, Northeast Pennsylvania, Sullivan, Orange, Ulster County, all the places we have up here, and how everyone can be so comfortable living here. You know, when Nancy was talking about her husband going down to the city and not knowing which way was north, which way was south, what's uptown, what's downtown, all that good stuff, because you get so comfortable up here and it quickly really does become home. So it was just wonderful to hear that from her and to hear similar sentiments from all of our participants. All right, so the last clip, I know, the last clip I'd like to play for you is from a conversation between two guys named Nate and Bob. And now, much like Jessica and Kirsten from earlier in the program, these two certainly fit the description of strangers with different political beliefs. There was also an age gap quite bigger than Kirsten and Jessica. Nate was on the younger side and actually leaned more to the right, while Bob was a bit older and leaned more to the left. But with the magic of one small step, you'll hear in this clip that they have a lot more in common, and if people like us can just take the time and sit down face to face with someone and talk, we can transcend differing political beliefs and acknowledge our shared humanity. So let's take a listen to Nate and Bob.
All right. What was your biggest concern coming into the interview? Meeting me? Did that change?
Well, I mean, I would say it was a concern. I mean, this is my second time. A lot of my nerves kind of aren't here anymore. I would say it's probably a better way to describe it is what's the biggest wild card. And I would say that's definitely meeting somebody that you've never met before. Like, you don't know if you're going to really, you know, link like we did, you know, bonding over, you know, in the military and our veteran status and everything, or if it's just going to be like someone that's just itching for a fight, you know, that, you know, as soon as you say you're a conservative, like, all right, you know, gloves are off, let's do this, you know, kind of thing. So I would say that's probably the biggest wild card, you know, coming into a setting like this. And I think it's good that we have, you know, conversations like this, because, you know, it definitely shows that there is a lot more commonality between everybody than what I think the media would have us believe, that we're all, you know, at each other's throats. I've met so many people who are actually registered Democrats that have so much more in common with me. But it's like, as soon as you say like, oh yeah, well, you know, I'm a Trump supporter or something like that, all of a sudden that wall goes up. It's like team sports. Then now it's just, everything's a fight. It's like, listen, we were just bonding. Like, can we just go back to sharing our beer and bonding? You know what I mean? So I think it's important. I think things like this are good.
Do you want to choose a closing question?
Sure. Is there anything you learned about me that surprised you today?
Well, I didn't know anything at all about you other than your name. When I signed up for this, they sent me this short bio that I had read, and I thought, that really doesn't tell me a whole lot. I didn't know, for instance, there was no clue as to how old you were. Mm-hmm. And when I saw you, I was a little surprised that you were so young. I thought they'd try and match us up demographically in some way, maybe with different political views, mm-hmm. but age-wise, we'd be close. No, I expected that whoever they set me up with, I'd be able to get along with. Mm-hmm. It's just my nature that, you know, I tend to be able to have a conversation with anyone, and especially among conservatives, because as I said earlier, I have so many conservative bona fides that, you know, that it's something that I can relate to. Mm-hmm. No, I wasn't particularly surprised, other than your age. No, and I guess I was a little apprehensive about the experience. It wasn't so much about meeting the other person. It was I was more apprehensive and concerned about making a fool out of myself, you know, and having it recorded,
right,
and so that everyone could share in that.
Yeah.
So I guess that was my biggest fear.
I mean, to piggyback on that, you know, definitely one of my biggest fears is how much I casually drop the F bomb in normal normal speech. I'm like, oh, I'm going to go on here and just be cursing the whole time. Yeah.
Well, and also, you know, since they did indicate that there would be some political differences, I was hoping that it wouldn't devolve into some sort of accusatory session, and it certainly has not been that.
Well, you know, and that's good, because even, you know, as an example to that, like when I was down in Florida, you know, I was talking to this woman from Ohio, and I'm just hanging out in the hot tub or whatnot. Her and her husband were there, and we're just having a conversation. And as soon as it went to politics, she identified that she was like a very far, far left leaning individual. And our nice civil conversation, just talking about how great Florida was, devolved into like, you know, putting it nicely, her being very belligerent towards me. And I'm like, listen, I don't want to talk politics right now. Like, I'm here on vacation. I don't want to do this, you know.
Well, I would hope that you would agree with – I wish those divisions didn't exist.
I totally agree. You know, like
– I can't say that we've benefited as a people, as a country.
Oh, absolutely.
From the way things are right now. Mm-hmm. I took political science courses back when I was a freshman in college. Mm-hmm. Just seeing what, you know, what would land, you know, and one course I took was political science. It didn't land, but I did take the course. And one of the books of required reading was a book called Elites and Society by this Chinua Achebe. Mm-hmm. And he points out in the book that the most important thing for a stable government is the peaceful transfer of power. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, duh. You know, that seems like the most important thing for living is not dying. However, And just recently, I read a book by a fellow named Putnam called Bowling Alone. Mm-hmm. Did you ever hear of it?
No.
Well, it talks about the breakdown of social structures in the country and how that has been the best indicator of the breakdown of democracy in society. Mm-hmm. Back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, there were a lot of clubs.
Yeah.
And specifically bowling clubs, but also social organizations, Elks, Rotaries, yeah. Odd Fellows, and whatnot. Those groups are struggling today. Mm-hmm. And so there's a strong correlation between social involvement and democracy.
Yeah.
And I think that that's probably a better answer than the lack of a peaceful transfer of power. Mm-hmm. Because by the time you get to the lack of a peaceful transfer of power,
you already have problems.
The problems have already existed. So I don't know. What led me there?
Well, I think it's interesting. Now we're really going to get into deep philosophical conversations.
We only have a couple minutes left.
Okay. I'm going to speed read this one. So what I think that really comes down to coming from a computer science background is that really it's us struggling with the internet. You know, and that whenever you have these huge leaps in technological innovation, mm-hmm. us as humans have a hard time adapting to those advancements. And so I would say, like, even with your example of the breakdowns with, like, you know, the Elks Clubs, the Freemasons, like all these groups that these social groups used to be out there, you know, it's because everyone's talking to each other online, you know, and we don't know how to deal with, you know, being immediately connected. Even anecdotally, like even like when I was in high school, like if you were getting bullied or whatever, you know, you go home at the end of the day, all they can do is call your house. Right now it's like you're connected all the time, and like you get these kids who are just getting bullied, and when they go home there's no separation from that, you know. So it's like this being able to adapt and use the internet, you know, responsibly, I think is what we're really struggling with, and you're seeing a breakdown across like the whole spectrum of social order.
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that the internet had such an impact on that, because I recently read someone comparing the invention of the printing press and the effect that Gutenberg had on society and the world at the same time and comparing it to what effect the internet has. And both of them have been very disruptive.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
and we've yet to survive the internet period.
Big thank you to Nate and Bob for, again, also participating and taking time out of your busy days. And it should be mentioned before we end that signing up for One Small Step takes a lot of courage, and the participants surely showed a lot of bravery by being willing to come here, you know, meet someone that they had never met before, ideally, and know that they were politically different from them and that there were going to be tough conversations, maybe not so tough conversations, but a chance that there were. And again, it just takes a lot of bravery and courage. And so we thank all of our participants for engaging with us in the One Small Step program. And I know, speaking for myself personally, it was definitely a rewarding experience. And I hope it was also a rewarding experience for all others who participated in it. And that's going to be it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. You can listen to these conversations that we played in full and all of the others on archive.storycorps.org. On Point is coming up next. I'm Ronald Kelson, and thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Dog Mountain Lodge, providing dog boarding and grooming, also boarding cats, birds, and other exotic pets. Located in Coshecton, New York, and on the web at dogmountainlodge.com. And from North American Cultural Laboratory, Highland Lake, New York, an experimental workspace for performing artists and inquisitive audiences, creating a space for community celebration throughout the year, NACL.org, and from listeners like you.
I'm Jesse King. On this week's 51%, actor and comedian Allison Larkin explores how grief encouraged her to live and love more fully in her new memoir, Grief, a Comedy.
We can spend our time in an abject panic, or we can take some of that focus and look at the love.
This week on 51%.
Monday night at 8 on Radio Catskill.
NPR shows the work behind our journalism.
So I had to search through 130,000 plus contracts to see if I could match them up with what Doge shared.
So you don't have to guess at how we got the story.
I've been doing this a long time, and these conversations are among the most sensitive I've ever had.
Support rigorous independent journalism today. Make your gift to the station. And thank you.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill.